Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Conversations Live, where we bring you the best in music, books, entertainment, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us. Now, here is your host, Cyrus Webb.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. Whether you're tuning in through Conversations Radio Network, we welcome you. Those joining us on the radio dial in my home state of Mississippi at WYAD 94.1 FM, we're glad you all could tune in with us today, as well as those joining us on the East Coast in Atlanta at 106 Live. We're glad to have all of you with us as well. Professor Cedric De Leon is making his first appearance on our program today to discuss his new book, The Origins of Right to Work, Anti-Labor Democracy in 19th Century Chicago. Now, this is a topic, when you hear right to work, that you may have a certain thing in mind. We're going to talk to Professor De Leon not only about what led him to write this book, but also the conundrum that he felt when he came to the issue of right to work, what it means, and also, of course, how it's being implemented today. If you're just not hearing about the book, we'll tell you a little bit later how you can get it for yourself. But Professor De Leon, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Cyrus.
Oh, the pleasure is definitely all mine. You know, the thing that you say in the book quite early on, and I want to actually just read this and then have us kind of begin the conversation here, is that you found that there's a thing when it comes to a right to work that, of course, when it was instituted, that it was supposed to safeguard, as you write in the book, safeguard the individual worker's rights to access the American dream, while simultaneously it denies a collective route to its fulfillment. I mean, is that kind of what was the seed for you when it came to writing this book?
It really wasn't the seed, but I do want to speak to that part of the book, because, you know, the right to work wasn't altogether a bad thing, right? I mean, in the sense that the right to work and freedom of contract was actually meant to prevent the re-enslavement of black freedmen after the Civil War was over, right? So the right to work says, you know, every individual worker has the right to contract their services with every individual employer, and you have to actually pay the person to do that work, and both sides have to agree to the wage contract, right? And, you know, through the black codes in the South, basically former planters wanted to re-enslave black freedmen through the black codes, and when the Reconstruction Acts were passed, they basically prevented that process from happening and basically made it mandatory for individual workers and individual employers to come up with a wage bargain before any work was done. The problem was that it was an emancipatory program within the South, but in the North, politicians used it to basically crush workers who were organizing for the eight-hour day, right? That's the sort of paradox of all this, right? With one hand, they're emancipating black slaves. With the other hand, they're actually preventing workers from joining in together to decrease their work hours and improve their working conditions, right? So that, I think that that's a really important part of the book, and I'm glad that you picked up on that. But that's not actually the reason why I wrote the book.
Why you ended up writing the book. So why don't we talk about that then, Professor De Leon? What is it that initially, because you give us an idea, for those who are just hearing about you as I was, as to, you know, what your work has been and being able to not only to work on behalf of others, but also the education aspect that's been very important for you as well. What is it, though, that initially led you then to write The Origins of Right to Work?
Yeah, well, I was a union activist and local union president in Michigan in the late 90s and through the mid 2000s. And, you know, when I was in Michigan, even though organized labor had definitely been weakened by globalization, you know, the outsourcing of union jobs overseas, nevertheless, you know, the teachers union and all the unions that I interacted with seemed very robust, still very strong, standing up for working people. And so, you know, I was in grad school at that point. I left to take an academic job here in Rhode Island at Providence College. And come to find out in 2012 that Michigan had become a right-to-work state, which made it basically on par with southern states, which had been, you know, right-to-work states since about the 1950s, right? And Michigan, as you probably know, is the birthplace of the modern labor movement, right? That's the birthplace of the United Auto Workers, right? And
right.
The idea that this place would go right to work was absolutely gutting to me. And that's when I decided that I wanted to return to the subject of my dissertation and write the book.
And this was not this was an investment of time. It was an investment of resources for you, as we're able to tell that as well. I mean, you know, I think there are some people who will hear this conversation, Professor De Leon, and think to themselves, I mean, what was the ultimate goal for us? Because I love the fact, though, it seems like you went out of your way to make it easy to understand. But in being able to go back and looking at history, it definitely helps us to better appreciate, as you were mentioning even already in this conversation, how there were things that happened years ago that have kind of set the stage for where we are now. I mean, did you know going in that it was going to be that type of a labor of love?
I didn't know that. And what it turned out to be was a kind of more cathartic and self-healing experience, because I have to tell you, once I found out that this piece of anti-labor legislation was passed in Michigan, and of course it had been passed in Indiana, it started to spread like wildfire across the country, I got deeply depressed. I mean, I'm a union guy, you know, and that was truly depressing for me. And so, in a way, you know, I wrote myself out of that trauma, and in doing so, I think, you know, I really wanted to tell the story of where these right-to-work laws came from. And I think one lesson that I try to make in this book is that right-to-work laws originate with violence against workers, right? You know, the reason that right to work emerged was basically right to work was a rhetoric used in the North, right, to justify violence against workers, because union contracts are collective bargaining agreements, right? When you bargain wages and benefits and work hours, they apply to all the workers in the workplace, right? And
right.
And they prevent individual workers from cutting side deals with their employers. Well, politicians said that effectively enslaved free white men. And so, you know, we had just gone through a civil war where, you know, we fought against slavery and the spread of slavery. We don't want to now endorse these organizations called unions that are trying to enslave free white men, that is, prevent them from engaging in individual wage bargains. And so the result were just these horrible, nasty industrial conflicts where hundreds of workers were killed across the country. And politicians justifying them with this rhetoric of right to work. I wanted to tell that story in part to get myself out of the funk, but I also wanted to, you know, demonstrate to workers where this stuff comes from. This is not, you know, because people talk about, when politicians say, you know, let's pass right to work, they don't say it's this big and scary thing. It's meant to undermine the livelihoods of working people. That's not what they say. They say that it gives you freedom,
right.
It gives you liberty, and all of this business, right? But once I find when union members realize that right to work actually comes out of a very violent history in which bosses and politicians used it to destroy unions and kill workers, then they say, oh, geez, well, I had no idea. And I wanted to make sure that people had an idea where this came from.
For sure. And I think for those of us like in Mississippi, Professor De Leon, I think a lot of times we don't think a lot about this. We hear about things that happen like in states like Wisconsin, and we hear these things that happen on the news, and we hear the uproar that happens. But I don't think we truly grasp it until we take out the time. Do you think that also, though, is part of the issue? I thought about when I was prepping for this segment with you to try to bring it home, especially for our radio audience here, is that unfortunately our nature as human beings is, if something doesn't directly affect us, we don't necessarily see it as a harm or a danger to anyone. Do you think that's part of the problem? People don't know enough about it, and they don't take the time to get it, to better understand it.
Well, I think that probably is part of it, but I also think that, you know, as humans, we also communicate through language. And part of the problem here is language, right? Right to work sounds quite appealing, right? I mean, I would like the right to work. I don't want to be unemployed. I want to work. And so if there's something out there that these right to work laws are meant to, you know, prevent from happening, then I want that in place, right? So I don't actually blame people for, you know, for supporting right to work laws. I blame the people who are using the language to bamboozle people into supporting it. But I don't actually blame people who say, well, that sounds right. That sounds good to me. You know, but the thing is that hardly any political rhetoric that politicians and elites use in this day and age is, you know, upfront and straightforward, right? There's always some kind of thing that is hidden, you know, behind the curtain. And you know, you're out of Mississippi. You mentioned that that you have some listeners in Atlanta. I mean, you know, right to work laws were passed in the 1950s in the Deep South, right? And the rhetoric changes, you know, over time. But back in the 1950s, you know, industrialists who didn't want unions to take hold in the South basically said, well, you know, if we don't have right to work, then what will happen is that white and black workers will be in the same union. And they turned to white workers and they said, well, you don't want that, do you? Right? And so, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like that this is the history of right to work. Right to work is, you know, there is a very, very noble beginning, and it turns in a quick way very ugly, very violent, and racist in many respects along the way as you follow its career, right, from the 1860s to the present day. And I think people need to know that, and I just don't blame anybody for not knowing that. I mean, Mississippi went right to work in the 1950s. You know, I mean, I don't expect folks in Mississippi to know the struggles behind that and the rhetoric that these old industrialists used to get white workers to support it. How are we all supposed to know that? I mean, I was born in 1973. You know,
right.
And so it's our responsibility to learn our history and then share it with others when we find out what happened.
Right. And I think, you know, I'm so glad you said that, because that is exactly what I hope people realize, the importance of knowing. And I think that's one of the things that we can all do in conversations like this. For those who are just tuning in, either on the radio side or online, you're listening to Conversations Live. We're joined today by Professor Cedric De Leon. We're talking with him not only about his book on the origins of right to work, anti-labor democracy. And we're talking to him not only about, of course, what right to work is, but also, of course, what it's been like for him to be able to share that with all of you. The subtitle of the book, the full subtitle of the book, and I should have actually said it, is Anti-Labor Democracy in the 19th Century Chicago. And what's so interesting about looking backwards is that you're able to then better understand what's happening today. So let's step back from that part, Professor De Leon, a bit, and talk about the response. What has been the response to this book so far in the conversations you've had about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I'm an academic, and it has gotten, you know, a very good response from the academic community, and mainly because, you know, a lot of folks, when they think about kind of anti-labor legislation or the anti-labor shift in American politics, think about the 1980s and Ronald Reagan. Okay, and I think that academics are very interested in the fact that this actually goes way, way back. It goes actually over 100 years before that. If we want to know where right to work and anti-labor legislation emerge, you got to actually get back to the Civil War, right? And so I think that there's been, you know, a strong response, positive response from the academic community, but even more positive and more widespread has been, you know, the positive response from the progressive community. And I was actually surprised by that. I mean, I'm a professor. I don't, you know, selling 500 books is a bestseller in my profession, you know. And what has been very gratifying is just that, you know, progressives, liberals, open-minded people from all walks of life have really been interested in the book, bought the book, and reached out to me, and thanked me for writing the book. So I would say that there has been, you know, good, solid response from my colleagues, from my peers, but there's been, I'm not going to say huge, but there has been a bigger, let's say, response from the progressive community.
Gotcha. Well, one of the things I noticed when I was prepping for your segment is some of the photos of some of the events you've been able to have, particularly one you had even this year where you were, of course, being able to discuss the book. You know, I do believe, and I'm curious to see your thoughts about this, one of the things that makes this easier is that, and you mentioned, of course, being an academic, I've been calling you professor during this conversation as well. And, you know, there's not always a correlation between books that are always easy to understand and digest. From those who kind of come from, you know, the world of academia. I will say this, you seem to go out of your way to make this easy to understand. Was that part of why it took the amount of time it took you?
Yes, I think it did, you know, because this was my dissertation, and I think that, you know, educated folks, you know, have a little bit of trouble, you know, reading this book because, you know, and I don't even know that I'm writing it in a way that's not accessible to people. You know, but so, the dissertation was basically totally inaccessible to, like, somebody who doesn't have a PhD. So I had to, you know, I did have to work hard. I went through the paragraph sort of with a fine-tooth comb. And I said, you know, this is not going to, I'm writing this in part for the progressive community. I need this to be accessible to the progressive community. And that process is still ongoing. You know, I give talks all around the country. Tomorrow I'm going to give a talk at the Teamsters Hall in downtown Chicago. And, you know, I'm prepping for the talk, and I say, you know, that word right there, there's no need to use, you know, $100 word, you know,
yeah.
in that situation. Why not just use this other word, you know? That's the pitfall, right? I mean, I'm proud to have gotten the academic training that I did and the education that I did, you know, because nobody can take it away from me. But
right.
On the other hand, there's pitfalls, right? Because you start to think and talk in a particular way that's not really accessible to other people. So I did have to try hard to write for just the broad educated public.
Yeah, and you did that very well, I have to say.
Oh, thank you.
I tell people all the time that I'm just a country boy from Mississippi, regardless of what I do for a living. And I tend to be drawn more to things that are easy for me to digest, that I know my audience will be able to digest easily. And this book is definitely presented that way. So that definitely, it makes it easier to have a conversation like this about it, because
that way I know
they will be able to take it away. So at the end of, you know, I think one of the big things, and I'm curious as to, if you had someone just come up to you, I'll ask the question this way, and they were confused by the phrase "right to work," how would you describe to them, just a, you know, just a regular person, as to what that actually is?
Right to work gives the individual worker the right to pay or not pay dues. Okay. In a state that is not right to work, such as Rhode Island, where I'm sitting right now, okay, all workers, if they're in a union workplace, have to pay either dues if you're a union member, or you have to pay a smaller service fee if you elect not to be a member, okay? And the reason why you pay a smaller service fee is because all the workers, whether you're a member or you're a non-member, all the workers benefit from the wages and benefits and working conditions that are negotiated at the bargaining table between the union and the boss, right? And also, the union is required by law to represent all workers, whether they're members or not members, in grievance procedures, in arbitration, and so forth, right? So basically, the idea is, you know, in Rhode Island, you don't have to be a union member, but if you're in a union workplace, you get the benefits of collective bargaining, so you have to pay something, a little something, you know, for that service, okay?
Right.
In a right-to-work state like Mississippi, you don't have to pay anything. You could be part of a union workplace and not pay dues, and you will be fully within the law. You'll be fully within your rights to do that. And so that's basically it, right? Break it right down to its nuts and bolts. Right to work gives the individual worker to pay or not pay dues. What's not being said is that when folks have the right to pay or not to pay, chances are that some percentage of people are not going to pay, right? And what happens
right.
then to the unions who are representing them is that they don't have the resources that they need to represent the workers, right? So it creates this kind of vicious cycle where, you know, the union, the organization that the workers set up for themselves to begin with, can't turn on the lights, can't pay for staff, can't buy a computer, can't buy paper, can't put up posters saying this is when the next union meeting is, right? And when the union has fewer resources, they mobilize fewer people, they organize fewer people, and the power of the union, the collective power of the union, shrinks. And the result is that you can't push the boss to pay you a living wage as well as you used to be able to before right to work, right? I mean, there used to be very, very strong unions across the South, right, particularly Texas, Louisiana, Florida, Alabama, right? I mean, there are mining unions in Alabama, you know, that were huge, were very strong, biracial unions, black leadership. I mean, the labor movement in the South was a sight to see, you know, before right to work came in and basically decimated all those unions. I mean, and now, you know, as you may know, you know, union membership rates in Mississippi are nothing to talk of. I mean, I don't even know what the membership rate is. It's probably below 5%, you know, if that, right? So that's it, you know. You get to pay or not pay dues. But if you can pay or not pay dues and some people don't pay, then the unions get weaker and the bosses get richer.
Yeah. It's, and I wanted to bring that up because this became a big conversation here a few years ago, Professor DeLeon, and here mm-hmm. in Mississippi, and especially because of our Nissan plant being here, and mm-hmm. there were some people who had some issues with mm-hmm. with the way things were being done, and the right to work law came into the conversation, and so mm-hmm. I think it, and I bring that up for not only our radio audience but also our larger audience, that it really does show how we all are interconnected, as you were just saying. I mean, there mm-hmm. definitely is an impact that happens, and it's great that we have a book like this that helps us to go backwards to be able to take a look at how this all began, and also, you know, if it actually is being able to meet up to what it was supposed to do. And I think that's the conversation that's great for us to have. And so we appreciate that. Again, everyone, Professor Cedric DeLeon has been our guest. The book is called The Origins of Right to Work, Anti-Labor Democracy in 19th Century Chicago, and it brings it right down to our day. The book is available through our friends at Amazon.com. You all can get it there, either the Kindle edition or the hardback edition as well. Professor DeLeon, if our audience has any questions or anything for you, how can they reach out to you?
They can reach out to me by email at cdeleon@providence.edu. That's cdeleon@providence.edu.
All right. So make sure you all definitely take advantage of that. And he also is on social media as well, so you guys can be able to find him there. We've already tagged him on Twitter for sure. And Professor DeLeon, thank you so much for the time today. I really do appreciate it, and safe travels to you as you go to your event tomorrow.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Cyrus.
Hey, glad to do it. And we thank your audience for tuning in to another great segment of Conversations Live. If you all came in late, you missed part of the conversation with Professor DeLeon, don't worry. Thanks to our online friends, you all can catch the replay right after we go off the air. The link is already available through our social media site. So head over to facebook.com/CyrusWeb or go over to twitter.com/CyrusWeb. Click on the link there. You can listen to the show completely for free and share it with your friends from there. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying, as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Make sure you take out time to enjoy some good music as well as a great book. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live today. You all make it a great one.